The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close just in view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, as we know by now, the once widespread and celebrated activities of ritual dance, powerful enchantments, communal entheogenic exploration, peering through multidimensional window areas, imagination cultivation by the flickering glow of the campfire's edge, and a whole grab bag of shamanic activities have largely faded to the brink of obscurity. And that invincibility-inducing trip to the stars guided by a strange brew and a rhythmic Icaros has been replaced by a trip to the couch where autotune barking out of soulless pop stars radiates from the flickering glow of a 60-inch plasma, just loud enough to drown out the sound of millions coughing up Big Pharma's prescription for complete and total numbness with a side of fries. Now, this horrific fall from magical grace may largely be due to the unfortunate result of its inborn slippery nature, or for the more conspiratorially minded, because it's been victim of a 2,000-year-old slash-and-burn campaign where rather enlightening worldviews and a sense of the spirits were replaced by a bearded man in the clouds and the material atheism counterpoint in a concerted effort to fill the minds of man with anything but magic. And it's time we shake that off, because from the Sumerian text to the layout of Washington, D.C., we can obviously see that somebody knows something we forgot. Magic is all around us, so it's time to stop hating and start participating, stop fearing and start adhering, because the spirits are home whether you know how to ring the doorbell or not. And so now, more than ever, it's clear a resurgence of the magical perspective is needed, and thus back in the THC saddle for a sixth time, ready to ride this wave once again and running away with the title of returning champion is the Sir William Wallace of Wizards, my friend and yours, Gordon White. He restored the magical context of our past in starships, he updated the spells for our modern economic reality and the chaos protocols, and now he's caulking up the cracks and stitching up the seams between the two in a new ebook, Pieces of Eight, Chaos Magic Essays and Enchantments. The proud father of three amazing books and of course RuneSoup.com, my primary mapmaker for the magical worldview, if sharks were sorcerers, he'd be the Great White. Gordon, my man, welcome back to my humble sanctuary.
Thank you very much, Greg. Number six. Sixth turn on the show. Awesome.
Hell yeah, man. Lucky number six.
Yeah.
And dude, it is always a pleasure. You know, I've got so many subjects I want to ask you about. I suppose if I started with the oldest, we'd start with something from Campfire's Edge. This is a presentation you have for free members of your site that functions as a companion piece for Starships. I really loved it. I think any THC fan would. And I think a major assumption the data you present there corrects is that magic is not something we created. It's more a part of our environment, as natural as thunderstorms. And it predates us and our noticing of it because it's baked into reality. Well, why do you think this is important to reiterate? How does it affect one's understanding of magic?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a linguistic trap that the minority of us who live in this late capitalist Western civilization fall into. Because actually, if you kind of widen out and look at the entire population of the planet across time, it's really only been us and a small sliver of us that have kind of fallen by the wayside. The understanding that the universe is in some sense magical is a word I use, but actually if people who listen to THC really stop and think about it, they're here because they're getting their head around the idea of extra-dimensional entities and psi phenomena and so on. And that means that you can call it what you like. You live in a magical universe. And that's kind of really where we're at from the perspective of sort of reformulating modern history, ancient history, the Paleolithic, and going the entire way back. We're at a point where materialism has fallen away, but we're in this kind of still scientific or technologically complex culture that has given us a number of tools we previously didn't have for the analysis of the universe in general. And it's throwing up things like remote viewing, and it's throwing up things like telepathy and near-death experiences and after-death contact in ways that are verifiable to the point where you go, well, this is a thing that exists. So if it exists, we need to fold it back into the model. And that's kind of what Campfire's Edge was about. We now have, admittedly, they are scant data points, but we have more than we used to about how the kind of human spirit world interaction works. And we should use those data points as a torch to sort of look back across the timeline and see if additional insights or an improved context emerges as a result.
Yeah, right on. And, you know, going with the magic is baked into the universe thing, you rightfully point out, I believe, in Pieces of Eight, that any model for magic really needs to work off planet as well as on. And when you fold in data that seems to prove that there are man-made structures on Mars, as well as several other bodies in the solar system, meaning, you know, previous civilizations, other beings, this has rarely talked about implications. Talk to us about those implications and how you kind of tie those things together.
Sure. Well, that's, in many ways, that's a gentle dig at occultist in the first and kind of ufologist in the second. Contemporary occultism in the sort of post-Golden Dawn, post-Crowley world picked up a lot of stuff from, say, the Renaissance to the 18th century to do with astrological magic and timing. And even though, obviously, by Crowley's day and even by the 18th century, people were aware that, and I appreciate we're getting into dodgy THC territory, but people were aware that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe and we were in a solar system and so on. Magic still functions in this kind of emanatory astrological way from the outer planets in, and man is this microcosm and so on. And that sort of works as a storehouse for ideas and correspondence for the actual use of magic, but it doesn't, like, it provably doesn't describe reality. And we now have sets of things that do, is the aforementioned psi phenomena and spirits and so on. But we also have, I mean, I'm a big fan of Dr. John Brandenburg's work to do with the sort of xenon 129 in the Martian atmosphere, indicating nuclear bombs that were used in the sort of 250 million to half a billion year old half-life ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a thing that I think we can reasonably say happened. I don't think he's maybe right that the culture that was bombed was Bronze Age and so on, but the science there of weapon signatures in the atmosphere needs to be there. And so we have kind of an emerging psi consciousness spirit world model here on Earth, and we have evidence in our near neighborhood of other beings of the similar level or more of complexity to humans. So what I'm really talking about there is, if the spirit world is here, it must exist throughout the universe.
Yeah.
And that is something we don't really think about, because that necessarily implies that there are, I mean, these are dodgy words, but like there are alien ghosts or alien electronic voice phenomena. And what I find very interesting about that is, I mean, at the time of sort of Dr. Brandenburg's bombs, there weren't even really dinosaurs on the Earth. So there weren't humans that were around to have a memory of that happening on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are things about Mars that have survived into sort of esotericism or magic, or even, I mean, back in the day, it was science. Like, that was the science of the classical age, right? That kind of match some of the things we know about it now. And you go, well, that's a surprising, it's the war planet and the one planet that appears to have been bombed in our solar system.
Yeah.
We associate with war, for instance. And you kind of think, well, where did that idea come from? And interestingly, however much it sounds even more crazy when you're talking about, say, magic and ufology, is you go, well, maybe an alien ghost, like quite literally, maybe there was some kind of contact with other parts of the spirit world. Again, it's, you kind of got to logically follow the model along. If there is a spirit world here, what does it stop? Does it stop halfway to the moon? Is it like a magnetic field? I don't think that works.
It's contained within the Van Allen radiation belt.
Obviously.
Right. And then we also have kids with memories of past lives that kind of jive with John Brandenburg's work to an extent.
Yeah. And so I really like past lives that kids remember rather than the ones that people who, and I've done this, obviously, most people have, but like once you get to sort of adult age and you kind of do a regression and find it, because that self-selects. And that's why everyone seems to think they're an Egyptian priestess or so on, because if you have an interest in spirituality, if the reincarnational model works, then chances are you've had, you know, multiple spiritual lives. So you don't get very good data out of it, because the materialists or the atheists don't go and get past life regressions. It's just the people who are already into it. So the data is a bit messy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like a 4-year-old, doesn't know or care either way. And so you get really interesting past life data out of them. And it's not to assert, you know, a full, because you're dealing with memories that have kind of crossed bodies. So it's not to assert that it's some kind of DV recording of an event that happened. But there, again, you get these components. You go, well, that's funny. That has a fuzzy overlap with some of the Richard Hoagland, John Brandenburg stuff.
Hell yeah. And you mentioned alien ghosts, but not only dead aliens. And I bring this up because in a recent magic-themed episode with Mike Sententia, I had a stoner moment when he was explaining his entity encounters on the spiritual plane. And I thought, is it possible that these beings that you're interacting with are the projected consciousness of physical beings on other planets? The same way people from different countries all log into the Call of Duty servers, we don't assume the people we encounter in the game actually live there. We assume they tapped into the realm from the same way we did, just a different location. And I think that that's a perspective I haven't heard talked about much. Makes a ton of sense to me, and you having much more experience with this stuff than I do. How far do you think you can run with that idea?
Well, Greg, I'll do you one better. I mean, I remember in the 90s when the manifestation of aliens that we would call the Greys was really, really big, like in culture and on TV and so on. And people who were taking this thing seriously say, like, who've either quote-unquote examined a body or had experiences and they don't have mouths that work and so on. I think they might be biological cyborgs that kind of consciousness projects into. I mean, if you look at how we're experiencing Mars, we sent a robot. We sent a robot that we can essentially think and see through because it's better. It's a better use of energy to do that. And yes, absolutely. There's another component of it. And Whitley Strieber mentions this in the book that he released this year with Dr. John Kripal, where he thinks one of the sort of hallmarks of an advanced off-planet culture is that it will have achieved a way of having kind of lossless communication between life and death.
Hmm.
And funny enough, we could be great leaps towards that if we had, rather than ignored the kind of 19th century Society for Psychical Research. I mean, it looks hokey to us now with them, all these Victorians sitting around a table or listening into a phonograph and so on. But the idea behind it was that this emerging technology of communication like radio and phonographs and so on could be, if we kind of doubled down on that from a spirit world perspective, we might actually build a way to do that so that you could essentially Skype your dead grandmother rather than your living grandmother. And we may presume, and this is Whitley's idea, that we may presume that there are off-planet cultures that have done that. And then that really opens up the kind of insights you can get about how the universe functions. So you're essentially looking at cultures that may continue to evolve where, you know, the dead and the living continue to evolve together. And you're going to start getting really interesting technologies. And for us as the experiences of that, it suddenly becomes very difficult to say, well, is that one a ghost or is that one like a live one that's using ghost technology or vice versa? Or if they has a ghost or a living one sent like a droid? And I love this kind of stuff. This is sort of very THC discussions, but this is the implications of sort of propagating what I consider to be the reality of the spirit world here on Earth kind of out throughout the galaxy that, yeah, I don't think it stops somewhere near Mars or wherever. And it allows or it invites revisions to the model of how we think these things function, but also kind of revisions to what we think maybe is the point of it all.
Yeah, man, it's a great through line. But how do you rectify dead spirits with the data that suggests multiple lives?
Because I don't think the reincarnation, one, or there's two. So let's assume reincarnation is a thing. I don't think it works in the sort of outward Tibetan Buddhist model where you're kind of caught in a washing machine and you go round and around and around against your will. And funnily enough, again, the sort of kids' past life memories suggest that that is in fact not the case. And so our natural home, if you will, being the spirit world, is where we tend to exist. And you kind of come here or there or wherever in the physical and an intentional basis as an experiential trip. So you can either do it or not do it. You can do loads of it. It kind of depends what you and other people you choose to incarnate with want to do. Now, that's to assume that the reincarnational model works. And I think it does in some sense. I actually don't like the word, I like to think that I like to assert the kind of sovereignty or the individuality of a spirit, so that you may show up here once and go, well, this place is fucked, I'm not coming back. Or you might like skiing, so you come back a lot. I don't know. rather than there being like a rule, like, oh no, you have to go back. I don't like the kind of forced high school metaphor of reincarnation that you find in the New Age, where you kind of move up the grades and graduate. I don't see that matching the data. Now, that's assuming reincarnation in some way is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other option, of course, is, and this is things that we do, in fact, have data for. However, something like remote viewing works, where an existing consciousness can gain access to information about things or people that have happened further up the timeline or further back down the timeline, means that you may not necessarily be remembering a thing that happens to you. You may be pulling it out of the cosmic library. So it would present as a memory of someone else because that's what it is. But you might have actually metaphorically picked that book up off the shelf and it will look like your memory. So it gets challenging, and the data is kind of split both ways. And so I wouldn't necessarily get hung up on the whole, well, the population's growing, so how can reincarnation work? And I'm like, well, because in most animist cultures, you'll find that the spirit world is vastly more populated than the physical. So we're not going to run out of people. But also, it kind of implies the either the washing machine model or the high school model is in some sense in play. And I think people need to examine that a little bit closer when they're thinking about previous existences. For one, I think that happens. I think people do come back of their own volition or in a way that isn't regular, again, like a washing machine or traffic lights. You don't just, it's not on a clock. Because like anyone else who's been involved in magic for, you know, long enough, I have a few of them, again, because I went looking for them. So it's not like they spontaneously emerged, but they feel more like memories rather than books picked off the shelf of the cosmic library.
Yeah, man. There's obviously so many possibilities. It kind of gets into the inception thing too, of how do you know when you wake up in the morning that all your memories aren't just preloaded?
Exactly. And this is all good. It's like going to a consciousness gym. These are all really good ideas to run through because it means that you don't kind of fixate on one.
Right.
And that can then kind of mutate or kind of warp either your own model or your own experience of existence. So thinking like that, I mean, this is, you know, it's classic THC stuff. They're really good stoner thoughts to be like, seriously, what if the universe just started half a second ago? Like, you'll never know. Literally, you'll never know.
Well, for sure. It also touches on that concept of maybe when you die, you wake up with a bong in your hand and a circle of grays around you asking how that last hit was, you know?
Exactly.
Or maybe spirits being like, so how was it, Frank? What was Earth like? It's crazy. It could be anything. And you're foolish to think you know for sure. But in a time when it's trendy to steer away from the physical ET hypothesis, let's hit it head on. You've been writing about this star in the Cygnus constellation that might have a Dyson sphere built around it, which I'll let you explain. But what's being suggested here and how likely does it look that something like that might be actually true?
At the moment, the data suggests it is the case, but the challenge is when it first came out last year, I was following it reasonably closely, and I gave a talk at this really fun haunted highwayman's in London about it. And one of the predictions that it is, rather than just sort of meteors or detritus that's orbiting around the star and thus kind of reducing its brightness as we observe it here on Earth, is that it will dim further in a year's time, in 2 years' time, which would kind of match with the idea that the Dyson sphere is approaching completion, right? Because once it's completed, we won't get any of the light.
Right. There's like a covering over it.
Exactly. That's what a Dyson sphere is. It's a cover over a star so that you can, you know, harvest all its energy.
Big project.
Yeah, it is. But again, like when you build in space, we're not that far off it in the sense that we're 100, 150 years off rather than like, you know, what's happening now. And that's happened. It has gotten dimmer this year versus last year. The challenge is, and it was kind of in that classic mainstream media way, at the bottom of some of the articles, it essentially said, oh yeah, so we've given it to these astronomers at this fancy university. And you go, it's right in the middle of the DARPA triangle. They basically gave it to the sort of network of, and this is what you would do, obviously, if you kind of think it's aliens, you would give it to the same East Coast University departments that give us, you know, those terrifying robot dogs and so on. So we're now at a point where we go, okay, what information we get now is necessarily going to be mediated, because you would assume in the background, behind the curtain, so to speak, if it is a possibility that it's a civilization that's further up the Kardashev scale and only 93, you know, like not that far away, like less than 100 light years from us, it does actually become a national security thing. And so it has gotten dimmer, but we're not going to get too much past that. I imagine probably sometime before Christmas, they'll be like, no, it turns out it was naturally occurring. And it may well be, you know, but we will never really be able to take that explanation to the bank because they've washed it through DARPA U, essentially.
Provocative. I love it, man. And I already do hear the flat earthers typing about how there is no space and you're a shill, and I apologize in advance.
That's all right.
A big part of Pieces of Eight, to me, is trying to find a worldview that is most accurate. As you say, once you kind of torch materialism, you got to have something to stand on. And you describe idealism as well as animism and say that it is more useful for the magician to consider living systems not as some unaware little eddies in a universal consciousness field, but as outposts to the spirit world. Such a perspective has a pleasing side effect of making the experience of day-to-day life much richer. Well, who doesn't want life to be richer? But, you know, can you explain or elaborate on some of this for the uninitiated?
Sure. So idealism is the idea, and I like idealism, let me be clear. There's something that Rudolf Steiner said at the end of the 1800s when there was kind of inside the Theosophical Society and those groups, they were beefing because they thought one of them had found the world teacher, and they're arguing over whether that was important, the usual kind of stuff that happens with esoteric groups. And he sort of said, look, the actual enemy, such as it is materialism. Like, we can kind of quibble over whether you think this guy you found in India is the world teacher or whether you think it isn't. But where there is more of an alignment in our understanding that materialism is false, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I feel about idealism. And idealism is the idea that everything is consciousness rather than matter. And so the physical world is a kind of accretion out of this sort of single divine mind. And it's sort of a warmed over Vedic idea as it's expressed in Western culture now. And it's like that explains the universe better than materialism, because as I kind of go through in that chapter, materialism doesn't even explain material very well. Like it's embarrassing, and it obviously utterly fails with consciousness. So idealism kind of works from that perspective. But you're still left with what I now call Brahmansplaining, where you have to, much as Richard Dawkins will tell you, if you have a spirit experience where your deceased grandmother comes and speaks to you, Dawkins will tell you, you're wrong. He will mansplain that was an error of your brain, chemicals, blah, 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 by my book. Brahmansplaining is kind of the same. If you have that experience, you will still get the same thing from a kind of Vedic teacher perspective, which is your consciousness is in error because you've accreted this ego. And so your experience of the universe is mediated because of this kind of false ego that you need to destroy so that you kind of, you know, dissolve back into the one consciousness. And so you're still asserting to someone that their experience of the universe is incorrect. It's fundamentally an error. And I don't resonate with that. I think both of those things, much like the sort of original sin, are there because implanted into spiritual systems for political and control reasons back in the day. Because mm-hmm. you require a qualified priest to tell you what is and isn't reality. Like, we've been down this road. I don't care for it. That being said, like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with idealism until it kind of breaks or bends a little bit and they get uncomfortable with things like sacred mountains or fetish objects in magic. So in sort of Hermetic magic, as a survival of the Egyptian idea of drawing gods down into statues, you can empower, you know, a gemstone or something and draw down a spirit or intelligence into it so that it literally animates, right? Mm. You can kind of work that into idealism. It bends a bit because it's like, well, that's another fragment of a universal consciousness that we're pulling into another fragment of it. But your experience of it is in error and you know, blah, blah, blah. And that,
right.
That same thing happens when you try to push the idealist model to explain the things I'm particularly interested in, like, you know, ufology and and
psi effects and all that.
Contact with the dead and all that. Well, it's all right for some psi effects like telepathy. Like, here's the thing. It can model it. I would prefer everyone who's out there, if the choice is between materialism and idealism, for the love of God, go with idealism. But if you're interested in magic and you have had experiences of things like haunted objects or books that have their own journey, which I think is another thing that happens, that works better in an animus model, which is the quickest way to get there is to kind of replace the word consciousness with spirit world rather than one spirit, spirit world. And so you're kind of in a situation where there's more going on than it just being one universal conscious field essentially vibrating the universe into existence. The reality is I probably suspect that is in fact the case at like the very kind of beginning point or at a very high level. I think that's how everything runs, but I think what it vibrates first is the spirit world. So you're kind of stuck. I think experientially animism works better. Now, when I'm talking about physical systems, well, living systems in particular, but sometimes other objects being an outpost of the spirit world. So a good example would be ayahuasca. The difference between a Western kind of Neoplatonic or Platonic view of ayahuasca and an animist one is, in a Neoplatonic view, the ayah spirit will be in the vine. In an animist view, the vine is the spirit, right? So, and it's kind of like an iceberg where it is the spirit. 2% of it is in the physical, 98% of it is in the spirit world. And that's what I mean by view them as outposts. Now, this, I actually have an interview earlier this year in my own podcast with a UK academic called Jack Hunter. And he's released a book about the impact of Charles Fort and the potential impact of Charles Fort on anthropology and cultural studies and comparative religion. Great book, great guy. And Fort had this idea that everything in the universe kind of exists on a spectrum between the unreal and the real. And if you picture it like a slider, you have Frodo as further along the unreal spectrum to, say, Obama. But they're all made up of the one kind of – everything is on that spectrum. Everything you can conceive is in some sense real, but then there is the sort of much more embodied parts of it at this end. And that is a very good way of thinking about how an outpost of the spirit world thing might work.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly get, and again, what I'm looking for, it's a chaos magic book. What I am looking for here is a model that best describes reality for the purposes of like further enjoying and experiencing it, but also for kind of giving you a bit more mental space for the practice of magic. And the one you end up landing on, and I find very interesting, and this is sort of in the Campfire's Edge presentation, the one that you kind of Goldilocks your way to, and I Goldilocks through all of them. I went materialism, panpsychism, idealism, and landed here. So there's one of those dangerous things where there's like, what is it? There's no zealot like a convert. Like, I came to this late. I admit that. But I find it very interesting that the first religion or first spiritual experience we can see on the archaeological record is this one that we Goldilocks our way to at the end of, like, you can literally think yourself to animism. You don't even have to experience your way there. That's interesting to me because there's so much of the kind of Western esoteric journey has been looking for the perennial philosophy or the Prisca Theologia or that kind of original spiritual system of mankind, because there's that widespread and kind of not correct, but it's nevertheless culturally there, belief that we are in a declined state from that original elevated experience of the world. Now, I think maybe there's something to that. It's just that we've described it incorrectly, and you kind of get some of that in Starships. But there it is. Like, animism is the first thing we did, and here we are two-thirds of the way through 2016, and I think it describes more coherently the most data points that we have available that we maybe didn't have available 15 years ago.
Boom. I agree, man. And, you know, you've mentioned the animist model before, but I don't think we ever took the time to explain it. And I think it is a pretty powerful model. At least it seems like the most accurate one that I know of. But to get back to...
I just want to jump in there, and because we spoke about thinking our way to it, and just say, I think the majority of people on Earth are animists, right?
Yeah.
Because it is actually how you're a pet owner. So if you get Richard Dawkins will come in, or a Victorian materialist, the guys who invented this premise of materialism, will come in and point at your cat and say, there is nothing in that. It is just atoms experiencing like the genetic drive to eat and breed. That is it. It is empty. It's a machine. And you look at this guy like, one, what are you doing in my house? And two, that's the wrongest fucking thing I've ever heard. And that's where I think people don't realize that the day-to-day experience of the universe for most non-insane people is very animistic. We get feels of place. We know that to assert that our pets don't have personhood is moronic. And that is interesting. It must count for something, that the kind of natural state of feeling and being in the universe is this one. I don't know what it counts for, but I think it does.
Yeah, man. And I did have a random question for you about animals, because I've been wanting to do a show about animal consciousness or how animals interface with magic, but I'm still having a hard time finding a non-lame way to do it. But not only from a spirit animal perspective, but there's also the suggestion that dogs and cats see spirits, or that Egyptians held cats in high regard for some similar reasons. I mean, I see my black cat posting up more and more near my ancestor altar, and I have to wonder, you know, do you see any truth to any of these kind of out there suggestions about animals?
The thing is, they're not out there when you kind of reposition, even if you do it as an experiment and say, right, I'm going to start modeling the universe from an animist perspective. It's not out there. That's exactly been, but that's been the story of human evolution, and the human journey has been the animal allies that we have encountered and kept with us: cats, dogs, horses, so on. And we see them, you know, kind of ritually buried with bull's heads, with Neanderthals, and so on. That journey of human and animal, because that's what we are, like, it exists in the physical and the non-physical. And yes, absolutely, the presence of the Egyptians were very good at it, because they had a kind of full language for which animals do what. But yes, the sort of elevated status of the cat in Egypt is not just because it would hunt mice in grain stores. It represents that sort of sensual spirit world crossing. Of course they can see, they can hear thoughts. That's it's very British guy, Morphic Fields.
Oh, Sheldrake.
Yes. I mean, he's got all those experiments of when dogs can tell when you're coming home and what have you. Like, these are animals that are, this is the animus model. Like, of course they can see or experience spirits. And of course, part of the reasons that they're around is that. And if you look at how we have historically experienced the spirit world, it's very therianthropic. So you'll either get animals or you'll get part animals, and so on. The idea that it's wacky or somehow fruity to assert that your cat isn't a spirit or can't see spirits is because we're trying to formulate that at this point in the timeline in the West, where, you know, in a post-Descartes world, the ideas that we're using of what is an animate and inanimate object are out of step with an animist model, and it's a historical kind of deviation. And yeah, I see no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah. And you're right. The animist model really is kind of the default position, even if most of us have forgotten or haven't been taught in school. But to get back to Campfire's Edge, another area of enlightenment for me was the importance of exactly that, the campfire's edge, or the utility of fire in our magical and cultural development. You say, when we got firelight, we didn't just get more time, we got different time. I agree. I thought that presentation was great, but what's this about? How so? How do we get different time?
Well, it's some interesting research that was kind of looking at when in the archaeological record we can see we sort of got fire from maybe 500,000 years ago, right? Or other hominins had fire. And it was a question of whether fire extends daylight so that we perform the same tasks now that we can kind of extend daytime into the night, or do we perform different tasks? Do we think different things? And one of the pieces of research that kind of, like, how would you solve that is you try to find cultures that have the closest relationship to sort of fire and sunlight that we would have had 500,000 years ago. And so you're sort of talking about like the San people in Southern Africa. And it turns out that fundamentally we do different things by firelight that we experience now versus daytime. Daytime is the talk is all work and gossip and a little bit kind of like mythology, a tiny sliver. But as soon as the fire gets on, it's mythology and songs and ghosts and ancestor tales and so on. And there's no kind of reason for why it would split that way. Now, what's interesting about that from a magical model of the universe is that you're changing your thoughts and consciousness in a ritual environment, which is inevitably going to attract spirit attention. That's sort of what happens. It's like watching a scary movie and then experiencing psi effects in the house. Like, you've kind of tuned your instrument to play something different or attract something different. And so we did this. And if you look at the sort of rituals that are described in, say, Deciphering Ancient Minds, which is a classic book in the area, the way early human cultures would use fire in a ritual was to kind of have alternating circles of women who would kind of clap and keep negative spirits away, and then majority male, although not always, shamans trying to bring down the right spirits or ancestors, and they would appear from the gloom at the edge of the campfire, these spirit beings that would then impart kind of wisdom or hunting technology or so on, but also the negative ones would. So the reason you'd have, at the same time as trying to call down the correct spirits, you have essentially half the participants warding off the negative ones because they would be shooting elf shoot at you and so on. And that kind of seems really important to me, because if you look at how in the classical world we model where the story of mankind getting its technology from is, and it's essentially, it's more or less universal, that the demons taught us metallurgy, they taught us agriculture, they taught us the kind of skills that differentiate us from the rest of the natural world. And I find it interesting that the kind of archaeological and anthropological research essentially bears out that that relationship with the being who teaches us these skills and fire is very long-lived. If you think of Prometheus or Lucifer or any of these ones that's kind of like the bad guy for the gods, it's associated with this idea of learning things at the edge of the campfire, where the sort of light becomes shadow. And whether that – I mean, some of that is obviously – pareidolia, which is the phenomenon of kind of seeing forms that aren't there because of a trick of the mind, but some of it isn't. And that's really interesting to me, that I think we've kind of preserved memory of that probably very important event down through 500,000 years into the story of Prometheus or whoever.
Yeah, that's such great stuff. And from one of your slides, it says that the anthropologically observable impact of fire is that 80, at least in this one pie graph, 81% of the time at night is used for stories or, quote, imagination cultivation, as opposed to 6% in the day. And it is, anybody who even thinks about it can automatically kind of put this together, that it is different. There's some mechanism, some switch that happens. And horror movies have been playing with that forever, but it's something real.
And so, like, the weirdest and most fun conversations you have at a party are post 2 a.m. with the candles low and everyone's sort of...
Hell yeah.
I mean, they're off their face, right? But they're kind of coming out of being peak off their face. So it doesn't matter what you're on. And that's when the stories get fucking weird. That's what this is, right? That's kind of like a play out of that same experience. The other thing that is associated with kind of fire and the spirits teaching us these technologies is the transmission of it. So as fire started to emerge as a regularly used technology 500,000 years ago, what will happen as the sun goes down, you will have hunters or hunting groups from surrounding areas kind of appear out of the gloom to share your campfire. And obviously that's kind of how hunter-gatherers work. Hmm. Sort of like ships at sea. You don't just kill them because they show up. Now, what that means is you suddenly have this vector of stories and songs. And when I say song, I mean it in the magical sense, like that's a spell, right? So you have these ideas moving, vectoring out like a viral outbreak because of the presence of fire that's not only giving you that ritual space to think these innovative ideas, but also experience the spirit world and then share that amongst human cultures. And that's the other part. Like, Prometheus steals the fire to share it. This is, this doesn't explain anything, but whether it's a quote unquote biological memory, or as I prefer to think about it, and this is very much what Starship is about, whether the memory of that event has been retained through the human journey since then, it strikes me as kind of quite important, because it's another one of those pieces you can reposition to say, well, okay, if that's where we first kind of got the big jump in quote-unquote technology. I prefer the word complexity, is for reasons, if you watch the presentation, you'll understand. Okay, we got to there. What does that mean about the innovation opportunities we have today, given that most of the public ones, crucially, most of the kind of like public innovation projects are run by people who assert that these things don't exist? And we kind of come back to the Whitley Strieber thing. What happens if we use the technology we have today and kind of wake up to the idea that these things do exist? You know, where does that go next?
Yes, such an eye-opener, man. And switching gears a little bit, when we're looking at human history and going back to the origins, we once did a show that, of course, hit on the pig-chimp blending hypothesis, mm-hmm. as well as the Mimi virus and directed panspermia. But it seems like you've kind of advanced your thinking in this area a bit and found some new data in the meantime and tossed a pinch of McKenna's stoned ape theory into the recipe. Update us a bit on your thoughts here and how fungus and retroviruses could be a more nuanced view of the ancient aliens idea.
I wouldn't say I've gone away from the Mimi virus idea. That's something that happened several billion years ago. And I'm still an interventionist. Like, there's no way to explain the emergence of life on Earth without directed panspermia at a minimum, right? Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the pig-chimp hypothesis. You're now talking kind of like 1 million year plus, whereas the sort of fire and human technological journey is still within the realms of what we can see archaeologically. I still maintain, and did in the presentation as well, that the emergence of fully modern humans doesn't make sense. It's not the kind of T-shirt you see across, you know, fat beauty bellies at a skeptics conference of the sort of ascent of man. That is literally made up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That is just like playing Lego in a museum. So the pig chimp hypothesis I still think stands, and as does the idea, I suspect, of a very large and complex virus several billion years ago kind of landing on Earth and unpacking. If you're talking about, and the reason I think that is this one, that could be simply an alien technology. Also in an animus model, remember what I was saying about the outpost of the spirit world? This is something I got from McKenna, right? So his first few, well, not first few, but before he kind of moved off this idea, when he says that the mushroom is an extraterrestrial, he says it's a being that is so old that only 1% of it exists in the physical, and the 99% of it exists in that kind of stone space you get into. And when you're in there, that is how it communicates with itself and other beings that it encounters across the galaxy. Like it is, he literally meant it was an alien that would seed itself on planets for the purpose of communicating, and you are then in instant communication with it across it. Like it's a fucking, I love it. It's such a cool idea, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what's interesting about that is because, you know, I'm a permaculture nerd, and if you look at the ideas behind how soil first emerged, because to get Earth, you could spit virus at a rock and nothing would happen. So how soil emerged is a guess. Like people assume that there's some like bacteria mutated to become some sort of mycorrhizal organism. So in the mushroom family, because you need both of those things and a whole bunch of other stuff to get soil structure to actually get plants. Now that, It's basically impossible that a bacteria can mutate into essentially a mushroom. Like it doesn't work. And so when you look at the origins of soil formation on Earth, I keep coming back to what Terence McKenna said, which is, no, I assert that the psilocybin is literally an alien and mushroom spores can survive in space.
Yeah.
So I guess if I wanted to update panspermia, the only thing I would kind of say to people is I think I'm fairly confident that the emergence of life on Earth is an alien event, right? So a virus. That doesn't mean that we haven't had dozens of different kind of panspermic impact. I mean, why would it just be one? Like that's kind of a holdover from a sort of very biblical idea of creation. Why has it not happened 1,000 times? I mean, there's this kind of joke going around, and I don't think it is that much of a joke, but the octopus doesn't resemble anything really on Earth as well. And in 2014, there was this kind of wacky, oh, the octopus must be an alien, ha, 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 kind of funny, I fucking love science ideas. But you go, well, hang on, why not? Like, again, the model...
Right.
predicts that the mushroom could have come from space and then we get spores. Life probably did in a sort of super virus form. So why is it weird to say the octopus came? Because it is weird. Like it's a fucking weird animal.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we know? And this is, again, McKenna was kind of into this idea. He's like, what if a lot of stuff gets washed through space and some of it lands here? And I see no problem with that as a model. Now, where it gets going back to the animus model and kind of asserting intentionality, especially for things that are only 1% physical, 99% non, is 4% of the human DNA is as a result of retroviral transfer. Now, what a retrovirus is, as opposed to a normal virus, is that it swaps out the sort of code for another, its host organism with its own. So we're literally provably built of bits of virus that have clearly changed something to do with us. And then we start to come back to that pig chimp thing and go, okay, so all this stuff is happening and we now are operating in a model that asserts, that can assert intentionality for these processes. Is it time to start having that discussion? Like, and I think it is. I mean, that's where I think the much of the ancient alien era comes from, is again the worldview dysfunction that comes at it, which is mostly materialist. But if you kind of jump to the parallel model of an animist or a kind of bad idealist, you can start to look at these things and go, well, what science sees there is sort of random behavior that, you know, 1 in 1 trillion chance happened to do this amazing thing. That's an insufficient explanation. And this is the opportunity to sort of remodel how we see the story of life in the universe, but also the emergence of humans on this planet.
Yeah, and you're so right that there's this tendency to think that it happened once. There's this one thing, but why couldn't it have happened a bunch of times? And also, as you note, another log on the fire is mushrooms thrive on disaster, and we are a disaster species.
Yeah, so the psilocybin mushroom in particular, because it's saprophytic, it literally colonized the Earth at the same time humans did, because we cut stuff down and we poop and we sort of alter the ratio between grasslands and forest, because grasslands attract the animals that we eat. And so we were just... if you played StarCraft, we were the creep that allowed psilocybin to conquer the Earth. And this is why everyone laughs at McKenna, but he's like, no, but seriously. So we have this being that has told him it's an alien that is built to thrive in areas of human disturbance, that tells us that it does this for contact with us, and not just us. It's done this across thousands of planets, and it is in that kind of immediate hyperdimensional contact with itself and other beings, and it's just kind of along for the ride and or the experience. And you go, well, that's like, sure, you know, there's nothing in that is wrong from a observable biological science perspective. The bit that people will quibble with, and it works in the model, is whether it is an intentional being. And you know, most of the kind of shamanic cultures that would use these things considered it exactly that. Same thing with ayahuasca. They considered it a spirit. So at what point do we take it at its word?
Yeah, sweet Jesus. It is a complex, strange history, and we long for simple answers, man. But to hop back to magic, you mentioned that the data shows that magical phenomena tend to manifest in cultures more open to them, and that magical experiences are made less possible by materialist cultural filters. I definitely recognize that, and as I said in the intro, if you're looking for a conspiratorial worldview, you might find it there, because you point out in your writing that as much as the Vatican did to destroy the magical worldview with its brand of religion, the Big Bang Theory was also first cooked up by a Catholic priest. So really, both sides of the magic-destroying coin come from the same mint. Is this a red flag to you, or am I going off the rails?
So Catholicism bans magic rather than says it doesn't exist, right? So that's kind of its thing. And that was the politics of the church fathers and whatever at the time. With the Big Bang, what happened there was that was kind of Catholicism or religion's rearguard move against, it's kind of like the materialist Victorian version of science, because it needed to reinsert itself, or it was fucked, basically. It needed to reinsert itself back in the kind of worldview, because I don't think Catholicism doesn't suppress magic, because the example of a culture that's more open to magic, so it has more extreme magical and UFO events, is somewhere like Mexico or Brazil, both very Catholic places. So Catholicism bans it rather than says it doesn't exist. It's just that when we move to materialist cultures like Northwest Europe or, you know, the North American continent or so on, then there is something about, there's a field of dreams thing going on with our heads, right? Which, if you live in a magical universe, more magical things will happen. If you don't, they won't. So it's unlikely Richard Dawkins would be abducted by aliens. Huh. And that's the benefit of kind of like really doubling down on this model. It is seriously field of dreams, or you build your own spaceport. Science, and it's interesting, the conspiratorial angle here is in the 20th century, particularly immediately following World War II, where the public version of science is still doubling down on this materialist thing, even though it's just not been correct since the 30s from a physics perspective and from a philosophical perspective, not since the 70s. Like so they know it's not correct.
Right.
But you kind of double down on it while simultaneously, you know, the alphabet agencies employing witches and kind of working with, you know, radiotic mind control and psilocybin and all this. So it's they essentially had like an evil Hogwarts going on at the same time that they're saying all of this is fake. And that's the conspiratorial angle. The reason, and probably by now, I think they know that the Field of Dreams method is in play. And I frankly think they're using that awareness in a highly manipulative sense as a kind of mass mind control project that I think they have been experimentally working out. If you can make people think this or be afraid of this and so on, and that is pure magic, and that's come from the evil Hogwarts. But at the same time, public science, you get former defense contractors in a bow tie playing a scientist on television and telling you this stuff doesn't exist, and that's the conspiratorial angle here. They fucking know, they know it works because they've spent millions and millions and millions of it on it over 60 years, and the public version isn't, and that's kind of they're taking all the magic and making sure that the kind of Western world has a view that doesn't allow it to happen except for the bits that they want it to.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true, but can it not go back further though? Because we talk a lot about the occulty black projects of the last few decades, but what was the deep state of the Renaissance era doing, or back in the time when you know, when magic is being banned?
Well, so that was banned rather than suppressed. That's what I mean. So Catholicism, or like Vatican doctrine, will assert that demons exist and angels exist, and you can do things like engage with this stuff. It's just that you shouldn't. So it's different to saying it doesn't exist. If anything, it kind of, it makes the field of dreams bigger rather than smaller, because you ban something and it kind of fetishizes it. So it wasn't a hit on whether or not magic existed. When you're talking about the hermetic underground that sort of emerged out of the Renaissance and kind of blended into the English Renaissance and all that kind of weird mix of, you know, the people behind Shakespeare and the John Dee stuff and the kind of thing that's trying to essentially liberalize Europe by providing free education and all these very hermetic and spiritual ideas. They were doing that as an underground for political reasons against the Vatican and the Holy Roman Emperor and all these people who didn't want things like printing presses and free education or any challenges to the kind of people that they put on the thrones across Europe. That was a political op rather than a magical one. Both sides of that fight asserted the reality of the spiritual world. So they weren't fighting over whether it was true or not. They were just Game of Thronesing. That's what went on there.
Right on, right on. That does make sense. It's so tough for me to get in the context of that day, you know. Mm. So it is what I interpret as the, you know, whether it's banning or suppression, it's that taboo nature of these empowering tools that drives me to want to engage in them. But my progression has been slow because you often say that magic will ruin your life. And there are always, you know, a ton of warning signs associated with it too. And I wish I had explored this more when I was 18, living in my parents' basement with very little to risk. But now that I enjoy nearly all aspects of life and I find myself walking to the crossroads offering in hand thinking, you know, what do I really even ask for? More of the same, please?
Yeah.
At what risk? You know, the risk of losing it all?
Well, unfortunately, that's in play. But here's the thing. Most of the discussion has been about the universe being magical, right?
Yeah.
So as I view it, there are practicing magicians and non-practicing magicians. It's kind of like the financial system or the monetary system not taking a position is still taking a position because you can't but operate within it, right? There's no, like...
You can't get away from it.
Yeah, people who be listening to this going, oh, I'm not that interested in magic. Well, unlucky. You live in a magical universe. Now, what that means, not everyone... Just because sharks exist, it doesn't mean everyone should become a marine biologist. But anyone can still get eaten by a shark. So... If you look at how magic can be a very unreliable tool for kind of getting the things you want. And it is because that's what happens. That if you look at it across the spectrum of spirit encounters from UFOs and fairies and whatever at one end, all the way down to kind of like, this still happens to me. Like when your sigil results show up and they show up in the most fucking dickish way possible. and you go, rookie mistake every time. That's just the nature of our uneasy interaction with the spirit world. Now, as a result, yes, I put it out there and go, look, I can't promise that that won't happen. That's the kind of eaten by the shark moment. But it's also the marine biologist eaten by the shark moment. Just because the universe is magical doesn't mean you need to become a magician in the kind of full-fledged, I'm going to go out there and do stuff. But let's wind the clock back 100 years or 100 and even 200 years. And in some places, let's not wind it back at all. But I'm going to give you a family example, and I'm sure because you have a Catholic family background, it will be similar. My great-grandmother knew how to get rid of ghosts. My Irish Catholic great-grandmother, everyone did. And she wasn't like the Warrens going out there fighting demons across the world, right? She, if there was a spirit somewhere, she knew the prayer, or she knew you'd use this salt or this herb, or the same thing with kind of like the evil eye or what have you with Italian Catholics. These people aren't Gandalf, but everyone had those skills like kind of knowing how to drive that you would use when you needed them because the universe is magical. And that's kind of where, and funny enough, the kind of enchantments that are in Pieces of Eight, some of them are there to kind of like, just put this away in case you need it. Because that's how, that was the response, the kind of natural cultural response to their frankly better awareness that they were living in a magical universe. You don't have to be the marine biologist, but I do think if people who are listening to this, who are on board with the idea of whatever word they want to describe it for, right? The sort of general stuff that's spoken about in THC. Mm-hmm. I frankly do think you need to know something to clear a spirit from your house. Like it can be herbs. It can be a prayer. I think you need to know that. I think you need to know a kind of like, that like walking over one's grave kind of icky evil eye thing. I think you need to know how to clear that. These are just things that every human should do. It's different to like, all right, well, I'm going to like, have a pact with Astaroth, and that's the kind of level that is a niche within a niche that you're either into or not. And those are the people when you're at that end, that's when like, look, this could comically blow up in your face like something out of Discworld, and people who are into it just kind of take that risk. But everyone else, you can still get eaten by the shark. So you should know this stuff.
So basically risky as it is, not engaging with it is no guarantee that it can't hurt you.
There's no not. I watched The Conjuring 2 last night, and I'm like an Enfield poltergeist nerd at the best of times. 11-year-old Janet, I mean, she got some pretty intense stuff out of unsuccessful like a Ouija board results, and no one else in that family who got the encounter with it or the experience of her mistake had anything to do with it. Like that's the shark attack, right? That's an extreme one. That's like a fucking Discovery Channel mega shark. It's usually just like, oh, this house I'm looking at feels a bit weird. I'll do some clearing on it or what have you. That's the kind of more baseline stuff. But yeah, it's like the financial system. If the universe is magical,
you're stuck.
How do you get out of it? You don't have to become a magician, but that's just kind of it. It's
Yeah. It's just a function of reality, like dealing with weather.
Exactly.
Gordon, another amazing time with you. To try to rein this steed in, you do have Chaos Protocols, Starships, and now Pieces of Eight, and you also talk about an unwritable fourth book. Just to put a capstone on this pyramid, can you remind the people about the synergy between the three books and, you know, the method to the madness, and give us any more insight into this unwritable fourth book?
Sure. So Starships is a book of history written by a practicing magician. The Chaos Protocols is a kind of book of life hacks for anyone who has a spiritual sensibility written by a chaos magician. People thought that was my chaos magic book. Pieces of Eight is my chaos magic book. That's what it is. It's kind of revisiting and kind of re-electrifying some of the core concepts of chaos magic. What is interesting, and I noticed, I didn't realize at the time, because what I self-published the last one, but the first one is Scarlet Imprint and the second one is Llewellyn. And the first two are written kind of simultaneously because I, you know, eyes bigger than my stomach and I thought I could do that and I don't recommend it. But there are the kind of, as an example, the presence of the Headless Rite in the Chaos Protocols, the context of headlessness and what that means kind of spiritually or from a spirit world perspective is found in Starships. And what you do after the Headless Rite from a spirit engagement is sort of found in Pieces of Eight. And the reason for that is that it would be a sort of 550,000 word meandering book of like, okay, so you do this one and here's why. And 100 pages later, you do the next one and it's a mess. Like that's not really how books are constructed. More interestingly, all those, and there, some of them are Easter eggs, but there are concepts, the context for which in history is found in Starships and in the modern day is found in Chaos Protocols, and the kind of thinking behind it is in Pieces of Eight. And if you look at the practical enchantments that are available in Chaos Protocols and Pieces of Eight, they're kind of locked together into a coherent system, which would be the sort of full fourth book grimoire. But you're dealing with, when you're dealing with magic in particular, it's so... The metaphor I use is it's kind of like the reason symbolism is used in magic or magic is contained within symbols is it's sort of like taking a object off a shipwreck and bringing it to the surface. And once it hits the air, it oxidizes and rusts and falls apart, whereas underneath the water, it's still coherent. And when you're dealing with – this is the reason why magical and spiritual information, I think, is transmitted – via symbolism, because if you actually just try to explain it, it's like explaining a joke. Once you explain the joke, the funny is gone. And once you explain this is how this works, it doesn't work anymore. And so the unwritten fourth book is all those bits that you can't explain or you break them. And they're to do with the sort of practice of magic. You'll get it. If you read all three, your brain will start to kind of like draw lines in between different parts of different ones, and you'll start to see this fourth book and you will get the idea of why that couldn't be, that book can't kind of really be brought down into the physical in any sense. By the way, they're all standalone. It's not a trilogy as well. So
yeah,
you may resonate with one or the other. It's just that the kind of bonus prize is the sort of fourth book, the kind of, yeah, Gordon's Chaos Magic Grimoire can't be written. And it's this fourth book.
Boom. Hell yeah, I like that. I think we did it, man. Of course, runesoup.com is your homeland. Gordon underscore White on Twitter. Any last parting words, Pimp?
No, again, it's just, you know, good to chat. This is always the fun show.
Hell yeah, I love it. You're the man. Take care of yourself out there.
You as well.
There it is, guys. Number 6 for Gordon White appearances on THC. That's 12 hours. But I always do have a blast. He's been here more than any other guest. I think Crow would have to be in second place with around 4 appearances. And I really liked this one. I pulled stuff from several different sources, and we really just did a grab bag of the things that Gordon's been churning out lately. I am in awe. The guy's put out 3 books in 1 year. I do like them all, but Chaos Protocols has got to take the cake because it can actually improve your life and prepare you for the harsh reality ahead. Yeah. Starships is great, but I haven't figured out how it's going to help people pay the rent. In fact, I just got back from a trip to my old stomping grounds in Missouri, and I just kept thinking how so many of my friends could benefit from that book, and I want to dispense it out to all of them, but then I'm the guy from California coming back and telling everybody how to live, and that's its own cliche that never seems to work, but nevertheless, it's a beautiful thing. And before we call this meeting of the Midnight Society closed, there's another quote from Pieces of Eight I wanted to use to make one more point. And our favorite wizard here writes, "Magic's great power has always been an ontological one. This is what we do. We map these dangerous roads not to defeat or change power. The new boss is ever the same as the old one, and it is politically and historically naive to think otherwise, but to build better lives outside the grasp and beyond the sight of monoculture." And that's powerful, guys. It speaks to a switch I'm going through and have been wrestling with for a few years. Is the goal to start a revolution and tear down the power pyramid brick by brick? Sure, it sounds good shouted through a megaphone in Texas, but is it wiser to admit you can't make people change? The system will probably always be there, and maybe I'll never really be in a position to stand between a puppet master and his wealth-extracting wars. I can't impose my utopia on everyone, and that really shouldn't be the goal. Maybe it is just more about a personal revolution and amassing enough personal power to step outside at least some of the prisons. It's a deep issue for people in the conspiratorial realm, especially when you can't force the masses to wake up any faster and life's too short to wait. There is a certain zenness to admitting that, though, a certain sigh of relief. And it might sound cynical, but it shouldn't. I mean, we all have to fight a personal battle against the system. If more and more people build their lives outside of monoculture, it will naturally weaken and dissipate, but there may always just be a certain percentage of people that stick to what they're told, and the meaningless jobs that come with that. The white picket fence, the freshly cut lawn of immaculance, and the $250,000 worth of debt that comes with it. It's dumb, but it's not my job to tell people how to live. It's my job to be my best self and work towards the life that works best for me. As much as I love it, I know people who would actually hate my life. And by definition, only a fraction of us will ever really be outliers. And just the fact that you're listening to this show means you have at least one foot out the door. But to take a line from the wise sage John Mayer, I do know people who are waiting on the world to change, and magic is about changing your world. So think about that, people. It's about all I got. I wish everybody the best of luck. I appreciate all the time people spend listening to the Higher Side Chats, and I'll see you at the crossroads. Your move, alien ghosts. Your fucking move.
Coward, it's your show now. So what's it gonna be? Cause people will tune in to hear another new conspiracy. Almost too much of. We thought this was low. It's bad, getting worse. So where'd all the good people go? They're on the Higher Side Chats cause it's everybody's favorite show. Where'd all the good people go? He got Jamar's coat in white and then there's Crow. They talk this and that on the Higher Side Chat, testing 1, 2, now what you gonna do? Bad news, misuse, got too much to lose. Give me some truth, now whose side we on? Whatever you say, turn on the boob tube. I'm in the mood to obey, so lead me astray. By the way now, where'd all the good people go? They locked them up, it seems, for protesting Monsanto. Where'd all the good people go? They're on the THC, my favorite show. Sitting down, new episode to hear. Wanna light a bolt, but I fear the police. Can you hear me? Can't interrupt me from this friendly conversation. Been waiting all week for THC. With the car wood, there's no hesitation. Exposing the truth, getting to the elite. Scams, schemes, conspiracies, and treason. It's an excellent show. What I need to know is, where'd all the good people go? Been only getting hate and fear from all the other hoes. Where'd all the good people go? Guess that makes THC my favorite show. Where'd all the good people go? They talk this and that on the Higher Side Chat, testing 1, 2, now what you gonna do? Bad news, misuse, got, give me some truth. You got too much to lose. Whose side are we on today anyway? Okay, whatever you say. Wrong and resolute, but in the mood to obey. Station to station, desensitizing the nation. Going gone.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site. If you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices, I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the five shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?